Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Elon Musk is to co-lead a new US government task force to curb unnecessary spending in the new Trump administration. So how easy will it be to slim down the costs? We'll look also at the likely choices to be the new US Treasury Secretary and at the startups empowering rural India and its people.
Now I don't need to go to Mumbai and struggle. I can stay at home and follow my passion. It's given girls like me an opportunity to represent my culture and make a name for myself among my own people.
And toy sales are down, at least in the UK, but many who are buying the toys are adults and they're buying them for themselves. So what's going on? And you can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033. That's +44 330 678 3033. We'd like to know what you think. Now, Donald Trump is still choosing his team for when he takes over the White House in January. He certainly seems determined to reward those who backed his campaign. And one of the biggest donors was the Tesla boss and the world's richest man, Elon Musk. At one rally, Mr. Trump suggested what he was planning.
I will create a government efficiency commission tasked with conducting a complete financial and performance audit of the entire federal government and making recommendations for drastic reforms. We need to do it. Can't go on the way we are now. And Elon, because he's not very busy, has agreed to head that task force. Be interesting. If he has the time, that'd be a good one to do it. But he's agreed to do it.
And it was a commission that Elon Musk was happy to accept.
All government spending is taxation. So whether it's direct taxation or all government spending, it either becomes inflation or it's direct taxation. Your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
Well, now it has come to pass. The incoming president has asked Mr. Musk to head a Department of Government Efficiency, an advisory body, alongside the former Republican presidential hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy. The aim is to dismantle bureaucracy, slash regulations, restructure federal agencies. But many administrations around the world come into power vowing to cut waste in this way. Does it work? Well, let's talk to Jaideep Prabhu, a professor of business and enterprise at Cambridge University here in the UK and author of the book, How Should a Government Be? Professor Prabhu, thanks for being with us. Is the US government particularly wasteful, do you think, compared to other nations and governments?
Well, just given the size of the government, it's very likely that there is a lot of wasteful expenditure and that it sort of dwarfs waste in other governments around the world. Their budget is about $6 trillion, so there's likely to be quite a lot of waste in there.
Yeah, and can that be fixed? I mean, Elon Musk clearly is the man who's been put in place to do that. What are the kind of things he could look at?
So it's going to be challenging, but there are probably many places to start. One would be digitizing government. So for instance, just having a single unique digital ID could do wonders for how efficiently the government makes its various payments, its social security payments, or even Medicare and Medicaid. That would not only make the system more efficient to do what it needs to do, but also reduce fraud and improper payments.
Do other governments do that already?
Very much so. So a sort of pioneer in this space was Estonia, that since the mid-90s has pursued a very systematic program of having e-governance as a cornerstone of everything it does. So linked to a single unique ID, Estonian citizens now can do a whole host of things online, from voting, filing tax returns, getting their identity checked, participating in the census, managing pensions, and so on. And all this has enabled the Estonian government to save something like 2% of GDP through this efficiency. But more importantly, it also increases the engagement of citizens. And Estonia has some of the highest rates of tax payment in the world. So if you just extended that 2% of savings to the US, that could result right there in something like $400 billion saved and maybe another $100 billion saved in improper government payments.
Now, Professor, I know you've made quite a study of India in particular. And And that is interesting. I think I'm right in saying that when they put money into people's pockets, they don't send them out a check like the US government does. They just put it straight into their accounts. Is that right?
Absolutely. So Estonia is a great example, but it's a small country. What about a large country like India, which is not particularly known for its government efficiency? Well, in 2009, the incoming Indian government, central government, invited an entrepreneur, a bit like what Donald Trump is now doing, into government. Nandan Nilekani came into the government and in Delhi to initiate a system of giving every Indian a unique digital ID. And in about 5 years, they were able to get to about 600 million Indians at about $1 an ID. And now every Indian has this digital unique ID, which now the government has linked to their bank accounts and does what's called direct benefit transfer. So all payments go directly into their bank accounts linked to their unique ID.
Interesting. And one other thing, just briefly, I mean, I suppose the parallel, India and the US, both are federal countries. You have states and you have a central government. Now, you might think that would be a level of multiplication that would be inefficient.
Indeed. So you can have inefficiencies when you have that kind of federal system, but you can also have, if it's done rationally, a very good division of labor. In a very complex, large economy or country, it's important to have something centralized, like a central bank or a single unique ID and so on. But other things can be decentralized. And states can do some things much more efficiently because they're closer to the problem, the level of complexity is less, and they can respond more quickly and efficiently to needs on the ground. Another benefit of having a federal system with states is that you can have a healthy competition going. So you can have states vying with each other to be more efficient, to use more efficient ways of doing things, and they can all learn from each other and become more efficient overall.
Some interesting thoughts and suggestions there, which perhaps we'll pass on to Elon Musk. Thanks so much, Jaideep Prabhu, there speaking to me about how you make government efficient. But of course, a lot depends on who you choose for the various roles. And one of the key posts still not filled by Donald Trump right now is his Treasury Secretary. There are two names being suggested by Trump aides and advisers. It's Scott Bessent and Howard Lutnick. And Bessent is definitely being very strongly favoured at the moment. Here is Scott Bessent talking to Joe Kernan on CNBC a week ago.
Hey, Scott, personal question for you. Should we expect to be doing interviews like this from the lawn outside the White House in the future?
Well, I don't know if you'll be doing them with me. I'm sure you'll be doing them with somebody.
With you, Scott, with you.
I'm going to do whatever President Trump asks.
Well, maybe he will ask. Maybe he has been asked. Who knows? Let's talk about that with Gregory Zuckerman, special writer at the Wall Street Journal. Gregory, thanks for being with us. Now, Scott Bessent, I mean, he's certainly, we don't know, of course, that he's going to be the man, but he seems very likely to be. What sort of person is he?
Sure. So Scott is a veteran on Wall Street. He worked for George Soros for a number of years. A little bit ironic there, given that the right in the United States and elsewhere, they're not big fans of George Soros. and yet, Donald Trump doesn't seem to care. He actually embraces that and admires that to some extent. So he left George Soros to start his own hedge fund, Scott Bessent. The track record and his performance has been good, not remarkable, but he is very well respected on Wall Street and, most importantly, presents well on television and elsewhere. And he has been very supportive of Donald Trump, and he may, as a result, get the choice to run Treasury.
Yeah, I should emphasize, of course, we don't know that he will. But presentation, as you say, is important, but also policy and outlook. And I think I'm right in saying he's very much the laissez-faire in terms of letting the economy do its stuff, you know, moving the government away if possible. Is that right?
I think what he is he's a little bit of a wonky guy. He's a policy guy. And he connects well with Donald Trump, who isn't a details-oriented individual. So Donald Trump wants growth. He wants to do something about the deficit, and yet he wants to spend and cut taxes. Doesn't really quite understand how to do that, I don't think. So Scott Bessent does, or at least he's got a plan. He put some details to the great instincts that Donald Trump has. And what Scott Bessent's plan is, he calls it the 3-3-3 policy, which means cut the budget deficit to 3% of GDP by 2028, try to get GDP growth of 3%. And that's going to be through deregulation and maybe some animal spirits that are unleashed with stocks flying and such. And an additional 3 million barrels a day of oil or energy in the United States. I frankly don't understand how they're going to be able to get that much more energy. It's already the country, we're already the biggest energy producer in the world. But yeah, that is the policy 333, and that's the goal. That's what Scott is suggesting, and that's what probably they'll embrace.
Well, Gregory, one other thing which we do need to talk about briefly, I guess, tariffs. I mean, that's a key thing of what Trump has been talking about. Is Bessent going to really be in favor of these really big tariffs that he's talking about?
Well, he's going to be in favor of them because Donald Trump is in favor of them, and you got to show loyalty and you've got to support that policy. What I think will happen is a guy like Scott Bessent or maybe a Howard Lutnick, they'll talk a lot about tariffs, but they'll use them as a threat and they'll impose them at times in some instances, but other times they'll just try to use them as threats because these are all well-versed economists and people with an economics background, and they know that it's inflationary, it's not great for the economy, it's tough for individuals, consumers and such if you have tariffs broadly imposed. So I can't imagine they're going to do them widespread around the country. But, you know, these individuals do surprise us.
We will see what surprises there are. Of course, we don't know whether he's going to be appointed yet. But thanks so much for being with us, Gregory. Gregory Zuckerman there of The Wall Street Journal. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's talk now to Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Russ, thanks for being with us once again. Now, I'm told, my producer tells me, you've met Scott Bessent. Tell us about him.
I did once. I was working for a major European investment bank as a stock analyst, and we were seeing his hedge fund, and Mr. Bessent was in the meeting, and I made such a fantastic impression upon him. When I went back to see Bessent several times, he never showed up again.
Well, we'll read into that what we choose, I guess. Let's talk about inflation, though, because you have the CPI figures out in the US, 12 months up to October. It's a little bit higher than was predicted, but there was a lot of fear that it would be much higher, wasn't there?
There was, and that's why markets seem to be taking it relatively calmly today, that 2.6% year-on-year increase in headline US inflation. The core figure is higher still at 3.3%, and it's shelter and food that are proving particularly sticky here, which remains a challenge for the Federal Reserve, because in the end, the headline rate of inflation has been above target now since February 2021. But despite that, the Fed is still cutting interest rates. It's done it twice by 0.75 point. There's another quarter point cut expended at the meeting just before Christmas. So you could argue the Federal Reserve is maybe taking a little bit of a chance with inflation in its efforts to balance inflation on one hand and growth on the other.
Okay, well, let's talk about a few companies that are showing something interesting at the moment. Now, let's talk about Volkswagen and Rivian. Rivian being a US EV maker, Volkswagen being involved in a project with it, and they are upping their stake. And, well, Rivian seems to be doing rather well off the back of that.
Yeah, it's a joint venture. Volkswagen already agreed to commit $5 billion. It's now committing an extra $800 million to take the total to $5.8 billion. A joint venture to develop electric vehicles and software. It's very controversial in Germany. Remember, the Volkswagen is pleading poverty in Germany and is talking about laying off staff in Germany and closing factories because it isn't making enough money. And the unions are saying, well, you're just giving nearly $6 billion to an American company. Hang on a second. So, but VW has to negotiate this transition from the internal combustion engine to the electric vehicle, and it clearly sees Rivian as a key part of that strategy. And as you see, Rivian shares very happy. They're up by a fifth today, although I must point out they're still a long way down from their all-time highs.
Yeah, it could be interesting to see where that one goes. Now, here's an interesting one. 7-Eleven, all of us know the store. There's a bit of an attempt to take it over. Well, it's a bit unclear what's going on at the moment. What are you reading?
Well, 7&i is the parent company, and it's Japanese, and it's quoted on the Tokyo Stock Exchange, where big merger and acquisition activity, certainly by non-Japanese companies, is extremely rare. Alimentation Couche-Tard, a Canadian company, has come in with a bid of $47 billion. The company is so far more or less a we don't want to have anything to do with this, but it is now engaging in talks with the Canadian company. There is talk of a rival Japanese bid to perhaps an attempt to keep out, they won't say it, foreigners. So we'll see how that goes. But it's a very interesting test case for the Japanese stock market overall. It has Japanese companies have been more shareholder friendly over the last 10 years, focusing on shareholder returns, improved cash returns to their investors. And if they now start to open up to overseas takeovers and mergers and acquisitions, that will be seen by the international community as a very positive thing indeed.
Let's talk then about one big thing in the digital economy over many years, really, which is Spotify. Now, you know, we've seen optimism with the incoming Trump administration. The digital economy, it seems to be very much in vogue. But Spotify's latest earnings, not what people were looking for. Why is this?
No, they were a bit disappointing, and I think user growth has been a little bit subdued. It was still up 11% year-on-year in the third quarter, but the shares are actually going up on the back of this, even though the figures themselves were nothing particularly thrilling. That's mainly because Daniel Ek, the chief executive, is talking about the company will make a profit this year, which is a major breakthrough for the company. And if you look at what it's doing, it is starting to grow its revenues by putting up prices, and it's doing so by introducing new services, premium services, such as videos. It's also cutting costs. It was announced last year it was going to let about a sixth of its staff go. So if it gets more downloads from the same number, even from the same number of customers, a growing number of customers through the same platform, and keeps the cost down, benefits of scale will kick in, profits will start to flow, and that's where the shares have more than doubled this year.
Yeah, they've done well. Thanks so much for being with us, Russ. Russ Mulder, Investment Director at AJ Bell, bringing us up to speed on what's going on the markets, and obviously that inflation figure also coming out of the States, very interesting in terms of the current politics. But let's turn our minds now to India, which has given birth to some of the world's most innovative startup companies in recent years. Now, they've all largely focused on building solutions for the urban elite. Now, however, in India, more and more of them are looking to the country's small towns and villages for the next stage of their growth. Our India business correspondent Nikhil Imanda reports.
Roll sound.
I'm rolling.
Roll camera.
16x2x4.
Lights, camera and...
action.
Ram Ram Sarpanch Saab.
Beyond the sets of the film Butter, a high-octane drama about power and justice.
So we're finally on location now with all the accompanying chaos and buzz that comes with being on a film set. There are big lights, diffusers, cameras, trolleys and monitors all in front of me. But this isn't some big-budget Bollywood film. It's actually a small regional movie tailored for a very specific rural audience that lives in the northern state of Haryana.
The location today is the village headman's house.
When you go to rural, when you go to tier 2, tier 3.
The film is produced by Stage, an app co-founded in 2019 by Vinay Singhal. He calls it the Netflix for India's rural dialects.
India is such a diverse country, you cannot put it into a monoculture playbook, right? Bollywood is primarily driven by a monoculture playbook. In India, there are 19,500 different dialects, and there are 18 of them that we have found, which are large enough, which can exist as an independent market, but there is no one who does content in them.
But with Stage coming into the picture, 200 Haryanvi films have already been made, spawning a whole new regional industry. It's created employment for 2,000 people, including small-town actress Nikita Sangla.
I have done 6-7 films as a lead. Now I don't need to go to Mumbai and struggle. I can stay at home and follow my passion. It's given girls like me an opportunity to represent my culture and make a name for myself among my own people.
In another part of the country, another startup, Frontier Markets, is bringing online shopping to remote rural customers. These are far-flung areas or tier 6 villages where the Amazons of the world have still not reached. Frontier Markets has a unique approach to getting tech-unsavvy village communities to adopt their product. They use local female entrepreneurs like tailors or shopkeepers as sales agents to build trust. The results have been promising, says Gautam Malik, the company's chief revenue officer.
These women entrepreneurs place the order and we do the last mile delivery to the customers. And since the women is from the same village, it builds a fair amount of trust in all the transactions that we do, and which makes it easier for the consumers and also for us to complete that transaction. 2022, we ended at $5 million worth of products and services that we sold. And this year, exit March, we should hit a run rate of $30 million worth of products and services. If you look at rural market, there are some 800 million customers sitting there. and close to 50% of the population of the country. There are 6 lakh villages in tier 6 markets that we cater to. So it's a huge market and exploding. So that also is forcing a lot of investment in the rural markets and social enterprise like ours.
Well, these remote villages in the far-flung corners of India have not really been on the radar of most of India's startups. At best, some agriculture-focused companies have made inroads here. But things have now begun to change as more and more investment begins flowing in to companies that are looking at tapping the rural opportunity.
In 2014-15, we had a thesis around online to offline.
Anand Daniel has funded India's biggest billion-dollar tech startups that have changed urban living. He's now cutting more checks to entrepreneurs building for the village.
More than 450 million people in rural India have smartphones and spend more than 100 minutes a day on their phone. They aspirationally want to buy everything that their urban consumer has. As $4 trillion of GDP gets created, we believe at least 5% of that could be rurally influenced. And that's a $200 billion market opportunity.
That report by Nikhil Inamdar on startups in India. Now, it's coming up to Christmas, and people are, of course, buying toys. But here in the UK, not as many as usually do, and not necessarily for children. Toy industry research group Circana says in Britain, a falling birth rate, the cost of living, and fewer big hit film franchises have combined to push the value of sales down 3% on the previous year. But sales to so-called kidults have grown, with 1 in 5 toys and games now being bought by the over-18s for themselves. Why? Well, Melissa Simons, who's Executive Director of UK Toys at Circana, said they may be buying Lego and collectibles, and I quote, for their positive mental health benefits as they spark nostalgia and bring escapism from global turmoil. So, how does this reflect the picture elsewhere? I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Maddy Mahalik, an assistant manager at the Toy Association industry body in the US. Maddy, thanks for being with us. What is this kidult thing that we hear about? I mean, what does it mean, really?
Hi, Roger. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, so the kidult trend refers to adults who are actively buying toys, games, and even collectibles that might traditionally be marketed toward kids. So this group, they're often in their 20s, 30s, and older. They're embracing toys, like you said earlier, not just for the nostalgia, but also for a means of self-expression, a lot to do with stress relief, building their own collections of items that they like, and sometimes even for investment.
That's interesting. Do they actually play with them? I mean, it sounds like they do, but it's almost hard to imagine.
They do. And actually, a lot of this has to be contributed to Lego. So a lot of these building sets that are coming out now are catered toward these kidult audiences. So they are definitely being played with. And we actually have a very interesting stat. So the U.S. Toy Association recently ran a survey with 1,000 U.S. parents about toys, play, and their attitude toward shopping this holiday season. And we found that 72% of parents are going to put a toy or game on their own holiday wish list. So this is a major number, and I think the kidults are here to stay.
Well, it's interesting. I guess that makes a difference for the people you represent, because you kind of think, well, do they then make these toys intending them for kidults or adults, I suppose, whatever we call them? Do they kind of change the way they do it in order to try and attract that audience?
It's quite interesting because it is a mix of both. So a lot of it has to do, the manufacturers are, you know, in touch with these trends, and they are catering lines, like, for example, action figures. There are really high detailed lines that are really catered toward adult consumers. But then adults also want to play with toys that kids are playing with, too. So we're talking about games, building sets, puzzles, and lines like that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not just things like, I mean, you sort of think that a lot of kidults, if we call them that, play computer games, video games, it's that. But I know that, well, some, indeed, my own children, play board games, for example, which you kind of think would be for an earlier age group. It's that kind of thing. And as you say, these construction toys as well.
Absolutely. And like you were saying before, there are manufacturers like Hasbro. They have action figures, you know, they have Star Wars, the Black Series, which is for that adult audience. They have Marvel Legends, which are also, you know, those souped up action figures for the adult audience. Mattel launched a platform called Mattel Creations, and that is all limited edition product geared toward adults too. So there are a lot that companies are doing to make sure that this audience is being fed because they are hungry.
And I guess it kind of helps them because presumably if adults are buying them, you can charge adult prices maybe, can you? I mean, I was being scandalized by some Star Wars Lego set that cost, well, it seemed to me, an arm and a leg, about $200-$300 almost. Is that the kind of thing? Are we going to see higher prices?
Well, the premium products will always come with a premium price tag, but certainly regular toys and games and puzzles are going to maintain those, you know, prices that we are used to.
Do you think there'll be more kid-ult toys in underneath the Christmas tree this year than children toys? Is it getting to that extent?
I don't think it's going to get to that extent, but there will be a lot of happy adults this holiday season.
And, dare I ask you, Maddie, will there be any kid-ult toys under your Christmas tree for you?
Oh, you bet. I am a huge fan of the Lego Botanicals collection. I have quite a few myself, so maybe there will be something from Santa for me.
You never know. Well, I hope Santa smiles happily on you there for that. Really interesting. Thank you so much for being with us, Maddie. Mandy Mihalik there, Assistant Manager at the Toy Association, talking about the way in which things that we sort of assume children buy, maybe it's significant about the way the world is going, but maybe they get this comfort from them in difficult times. Anyway, I hope whatever's under your Christmas tree is very nice. That's World Business Report.